cases 2025-50693, Wendy Davis et al. Versus Eliezer Cisneros. We'll hear from Mr. Canseco.
May it please the court, my name is Francisco Canseco. I'm here representing the appellant, Eliezer Cisneros, and I'd like to start out by saying that the court should reverse the judgment because the district court permitted section 1985, subsection 3, liability based on partisan politics hostility without proof of racial or protected class discriminatory animus and without state action for what is at the bottom of the First Amendment political advocacy theory. Appellant seeks reversal and entry of judgment in his favor, or at minimum, vacature and remand for new trial. The appeal presents two legal questions. The first one, whether section 1985, subsection 3, required appellees to prove race-based or protected class discriminatory animus. Appellant's reply identifies that as the first question presented. And second, whether the supporter advocacy clause can reach private interference with political campaign activities absent state action. The appellant's reply identifies that as the second question presented, and the issues are legal and reviewed de novo. The appellant's reply frames statutory interpretation and the required legal elements of the cause of action as de novo issues. Under 42 section 1985 subsection 3, it requires racial or protected class animus. Griffin, Supreme Court case, supplies the limiting principle. The Supreme Court explained that section 1985 subsection 3 is not a general federal tort law and that the status requires some racial or perhaps otherwise class-based invidiously discriminatory animus. The Fifth Circuit authority applies that limitation strictly. Doibert states that only conspiracies motivated by racial animus are cognizable under section 1985, subsection 3, as this circuit has so stated. Bryan likewise states that in this circuit, section 1985, subsection 3 claims require an allegation of race-based conspiracies. Dangle rejected section 1985, subsection 3, liability for economic or commercial animus, and held that basis against non-union workers does not satisfy the statute. The point for these cases is very straightforward. Appellee's theory is partisan political hostility, not racial or protected class animus. Appellant's reply states that the record contains no evidence of race-based animus or animus based on any protected class characteristic. The reply further states that the appellees alleged only that the appellant and others opposed the Biden-Harris campaign and sought to disrupt the campaign activities. If the court accepts appellee's theory, section 1985, subsection 3, becomes a federal remedy for political confrontations whenever one side claims disruption. Griffin forbids that expansion because the statute must not reach all tortious conspiratorial interferences. Support and advocacy cannot erase constitutional limits. The statutory text matters. Section 1985, subsection 3, separately prohibits conspiracies to prevent a lawful voter by force, intimidation, or threat from giving support or advocacy in favor of a federal candidate. But the existence of that clause does not answer whether the district court would impose civil liability here without the limiting principles required by Griffin and the Fifth Circuit precedent. The appellees rely on Cush, but Cush is distinguishable. Cush addresses the first part of Section 1985, subsection 2, involving alleged intimidation of potential witnesses in federal litigation, and it held that the critical Section 1985, subsection 3, equal protection language did not apply to that of Section 1985, subsection 2 claims. Cush did not involve the modern use of Section 1985, subsection 3, to impose civil liabilities for private partisan campaign conflicts. The appellees also rely on Pains, but the present appeal is materially different as framed by the appellant. Appellant's reply distinguishes Pains as a voter registration intimidation case, while describing this case as involving private political expression on public highways without race or protected class animus. And I must point out that the facts of Payne clearly point out that the plaintiff in that case was an African American. And throughout it was shown that animosity had existed between the defendants and the plaintiffs with voter registration on plaintiffs. In this case, the jury found the appellant Cisneros liable under subsection 1985, subsection 3, and awarded Holloway $10,000 in compensatory damages and awarded $30,000 in punitive damages. The district court denied appellant's post-trial motions and entered final judgment on August 1st, 2025. But the legal defect preceded the verdict. The district court permitted the claim to go to the jury without requiring proof of class-based animus. The appellant's reply argues that the jury was not instructed to find class-based discriminatory animus and that this was legal error. In closing, I would say that the narrow ruling that the appellant seeks is that Section 1985, subsection 3, cannot be used to impose federal civil rights liability for partisan political conflict without proof of racial or protected class discriminatory animus. That ruling follows Griffin, Doibert, Bryan, and Dengley. For these reasons, the court should reverse and render judgment for appellant or alternatively to vacate and remand for a new trial.
I notice you're reading your brief. Did you use artificial intelligence to draft either the initial or the reply brief?
No. What I did was that I researched with NexusLexis, and I constructed my arguments accordingly. And I put them down simply because I'm 77 years old, and I'm having a little bit of trouble minding my straight away.
Are you sure artificial intelligence wasn't used to prepare whatever you were relying on?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Did you have people write your brief for you that you relied on?
Judge, I am the receptionist, the research analyst, the biller, and the head cook and bottle washer in my office. I'm a solo practitioner.
So when you say it wasn't used, you're pretty positive you know what the situation is.
I know the situation, okay, fully.
Anybody have any questions? Hearing none, we have your argument. Thank you very much, Council. We appreciate it. We'll hear from Ms. Ross.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Erica Ross for the appellees. I heard my friend this morning to note that he has preserved only two issues for this appeal. We very much agree. Those two questions are whether the supporter advocacy clause requires race-based or other class-based animus, and second, whether it does not provide substantive rights, but is simply an enforcement mechanism for rights found elsewhere. I think both of the appellant's arguments fail for much the same reason. The text of the support or advocacy clause simply includes none of those limitations. The statute, the cases on which Mr. Cisneros relies that impose those types of requirements all concern a different provision of Section 1985(3) that refers to the equal protection of the laws or the equal privileges and immunities of the laws. That equal requirement is where the Supreme Court in Griffin got the race-based animus requirement, and the reference to the privileges and immunities of the laws or the protection of the laws is where courts have derived the requirement that we look to another source of law. So, for example, the First Amendment or voting rights, as Mr. Cisneros has suggested in his papers.
What do you make of the fact that 1985, I'm going to call it Clause B, or Clause 2, if you know what I mean.
But, sure.
So 1985, subsection 3, the middle piece, the supportive advocacy clause, three times uses the word or derivation thereof of lawful or legal, right? So it has to be a citizen who's lawfully entitled to vote, it has to be advocacy in a legal manner, and it has to be a lawfully qualified person as an elector, member of Congress, et cetera.
Sure.
Doesn't that textually suggest that whatever the substance of the right is protected in 1985 has to be determined by an exogenous source that gives us the lawful characteristics of those three elements?
So, Judge Oldham, I agree that you need to know whether somebody is lawfully entitled to vote, for example. I don't think that that means that for the source of the right, say whether we are looking at a First Amendment violation or mere support or advocacy, that we also look externally. I think you are right that Congress has imposed some constraints on the statute, and I think what each of the ones that you read off demonstrates is that Congress was very much focused on an area of federal concern. It was making sure that we were talking about the federal electorate in acting lawfully for federal elections, support or advocacy with respect to federal elections. I don't think what it was doing is using the phrase support or advocacy to actually mean First Amendment rights or voting. In fact, it would have been quite easy to say those things. Of course, the word vote itself is in the support or advocacy clause, just three words earlier when, as Your Honor mentioned, there's the lawfully entitled to vote language. And, of course, there was also a statute that had been enacted a year before in 1870 that protected against conspiracies of much the same variety targeted at voting. And so Congress, I think, quite clearly went broader in Section 1985(3) in this one respect, where it used supporter advocacy rather than referencing the equal protection of the laws or the privileges and immunities of the laws, or specifically limiting it to voting or to First Amendment concerns.
In 1871, prior to United States versus Classic, obviously, which didn't come for 75 more years, where would I have gone to determine whether a plaintiff, a 1985 subsection 3 plaintiff, was lawfully entitled to vote?
Your Honor, I assume you would have looked to state law at that point.
And isn't that the answer then? Right? I mean, I agree with you, right? As far as I can think of, I can't think of a federal entitlement to vote, again, in 1871. So I would have to look outside of 1985 subsection 3 to figure out whether you've pled a proper 1985 subsection 3 claim, right? It's, in that sense, it would be just like, as you point out, the privileges and immunities piece. It would be just like 1983. We would use it as a cause of action, an important one, but the elements, the substantive violations and stuff, we would go outside to find them.
So respectfully, Judge Oldham, I disagree with the breadth of that statement. I think it is true with respect to particular elements that you have pointed out, the entitlement to vote, for example, but I don't think it's true with respect to support or advocacy, and that's the question here. The question here is, with respect to support or advocacy, does that require a violation of the First Amendment? And I think it clearly doesn't. It's both broader and narrower than the First Amendment. Support or advocacy for a candidate who is qualified for a federal election is obviously much narrower than the First Amendment generally if we're looking at a specific type of federally targeted speech. And so we're not looking at speech generally. But by the same token, I don't think there's anything in the text of the statute that would give you a state action requirement. And so in that sense, it is broader. And so I just don't think that this statute is on all fours with or is seeking to enforce a First Amendment right specifically, even if it's true that some elements, that some elements need to, you need to look to state law for those.
Sure. So let me give you the state action thing for present purposes. I'm more focused on the, is there a substantive right buried in here somewhere? I appreciate the candor on the lawful entitlement to vote. It doesn't say supporter advocacy. It says supporter advocacy in a
legal manner.
So where would I go in 1871 to figure out what that meant?
So I think the First Amendment might be part of that, because obviously if you're as here, and I do want to touch on the facts at some point because I think they were a little bit misdescribed this morning, but I think if you, you know, if your supporter advocacy takes the form obviously of violence or something like that, it's not going to be lawful under state or federal law. I mean, there could be various requirements. I don't think you would necessarily look to state law alone at that point.
Well, what would be the federal content of the right of in a legal manner if it wasn't the First Amendment and it wasn't state law in 1871?
Your Honor, so obviously none of this has been briefed, of course, and so I'm just trying to engage as best I can. I don't know what specific 1870 statutes were on the books with regard to harassing campaign or, you know, intimidating people who were trying to campaign. It's possible there's something else I'm not aware of at this moment as I stand here. But, you know, I think even if I spot that those requirements would be state law requirements, I still think the whether support or advocacy is something that has its own content apart from the confines that my friend has suggested, which are simply the First Amendment or voting. I think it's very clear that it does, because again, the word vote isn't in there, and it is clearly not limited to the First Amendment because, among other things, there's no state action requirement. It simply refers to two or more persons, et cetera. If I could touch on the facts, because I know that there was some discussion of that this morning, I would really encourage the court to, if you're concerned about the facts here, I don't think there really has been a challenge made to the sufficiency of the evidence, although I got kind of a flavor of that perhaps this morning. I think it's really important to read the district court's opinion on the judgment as a matter of law. I think the district court goes through this really closely in terms of whether this was just, as my colleague suggested, partisan campaign tactics, or whether this was really something that was quite dangerous. And, you know, there was expert testimony at trial. The jury heard and saw videos and photos of this event. And I think there was more than sufficient evidence to show that it created quite a dangerous situation. There was brake checking, there was sort of surrounding of the bus, and ultimately did cause an accident, which Mr. Cisneros then bragged about on social media in words I will not use in this court. And so I think, you know, there's more than enough on the facts. I don't think there is a danger here that reading the statute as it is written is somehow going to translate into federalization of, you know, partisan political disagreements, as I heard my colleague to suggest this morning.
And why is that? I mean, why would not? It strikes me that in terms of your best case, tell me I'm wrong about this, but your best case in terms of how to understand 1985 subsection 3 clause 2 or whatever B has to be Goldman, right? I mean, Goldman's got great language for you. It's obviously written by a future Supreme Court justice. It's relevantly contemporaneous with the time. It presumes all of the answers to the questions I was asking you 5 minutes ago about, like, where would I look for the rights? I mean, it talks quite honestly and openly about where those federal rights would have existed in the 1870s. And so that's got to be the best case, right? Do you have a better case in terms of how to understand what the meaning of supporter advocacy in a legal manner is?
So, Your Honor, I guess it depends on exactly what you mean by that. Sure. I would say one of our best cases is Cush from the Supreme Court, because it makes so clear that you need to go sort of provision by provision, and we can't be reading in things from the Equal Protection Clause of 1985 into this provision, which I take it to be much of my friend's argument is really trying to do that. All of the cases that he was discussing this morning are under the Equal Protection Clause.
And I appreciate that, and it's very important for you to respond to him. I hear that. I'm asking a different question,
sure.
Right? Which is obviously Cush is not a whatever subsection B, clause B case, and doesn't really talk about, for obvious reasons, what it means to support or advocate in a legal manner. Goldman does. Do you have a better case? Because I want to talk about Goldman with
sure,
you for a minute,
but
like,
I'm happy to talk about Goldman.
Okay. So if that's the best case, there's some incredible language in this opinion, right? Any interference with the right of an elector to make up his mind how he shall vote is such an interference with the right to vote as if he were prevented from depositing his ballot in the ballot box after he made up his mind. I mean, that's anything, right? I mean, that's online harassment, that's the dissemination of misinformation memes on Twitter. What about someone, two young people who get into pickup trucks and drive onto my lawn and then destroy my yard signs that, you know, are absolutely supporting a candidate for federal office? Is that a 1985 subsection 3 clause 2 violation?
Sure. So I want to respond to the hypothetical, and then I want to get back to Goldman. So on the hypothetical, Your Honor, I think we would have to run this through. I take it there's about 8 requirements of the statute. And mm-hmm. So I think you would need a conspiracy that someone has joined with a specific intent.
Okay. Two people.
But the specific intent there, I think, is important. It needs to be to prevent supporter advocacy or to injure someone on behalf of their supporter advocacy through intimidation, force, or threat. I'm not sure if just pulling a yard sign is necessarily going to be enough for that.
No, they drove onto my yard. I got it all on a Ring camera. So they drive into my yard and they run over my signs. And so they definitely injure my property. Mm-hmm. They definitely do it through force. Okay. They definitely prevent my lawful advocacy in support of let's make them presidential signs for sake of hypothesis.
Sure.
I mean, 1985 subsection 3, right?
So I think you might well have a cause of action there, Your Honor. And I think what's important here is that is not altogether shocking. I think, you know, the idea that is kind of normal partisan back and forth, I don't think anyone should accept. I think the idea that this is, you know, quite unacceptable conduct and that Congress in 1871 had every reason to be concerned about people by force, intimidation, or threat trying to stop lawful advocacy for federal candidates. I mean, if you look at Cush, among other things, talks about a D.C. Circuit case called McCord that goes through the history of the time. And the D.C. Circuit made very clear there that what Congress was facing in 1871 was really destabilizing to the nation as a whole. And it was very concerned not just about racial violence, but about political violence, about people being intimidated out of exercising their right to campaign for folks or to vote itself.
And what about shouting down a campaign surrogate at a campaign stop?
I think it would be very difficult to make that argument. I think,
your client,
of course, there's a First Amendment backstop as well, no. Your Honor. And so I think
your client makes this point, right? I mean, your client in his deposition alleges that part of this claim is that in different parts and different stops, I mean, we can go through it. It's at ROA 29174, that the plaintiffs in this case were shouted down at various campaign stops. So would that, I mean, again, just to, we can make the hypothetical as strong as you want to, but, you know, it's obviously a conspiracy. Lots of people, they all agree in advance. We're going to go and be disruptive. We've all seen these videos.
Sure.
And
I didn't mean to interrupt you, gentlemen.
Please.
So I don't have that page of the record in front of me at the moment. If memory serves, that testimony was actually saying that, you know, yeah, they shouted me down. That's kind of like what happens sometimes. You don't really take it to, I may be thinking of the wrong page. The page that I'm thinking of has that kind of discussion. But in any event, you know, I think what the jury had in front of it here was not, there was no request for sort of a specialized verdict form in this case where you would have to check off, you know, yeah, it was the screaming versus something else. But what the jury had in front of it here was a situation in which, as I mentioned earlier, the bus was surrounded. There were posts beforehand about blocking the bus, physically blocking the bus. Some of the text messages here are not available from beforehand because, of course, the district court found that Mr. Cisneros destroyed evidence and that the jury could, but did not have to presume that evidence would have been helpful to plaintiffs. And then you have video and photos of about 100 cars swarming the bus, surrounding it, brake checking it in front of it, creating what the experts said were dangerous conditions that could have in fact led to catastrophic consequences and in fact did cause a car crash. And so I don't think the fact that someone might have, you know, there might be applications of this statute where somebody could have a good First Amendment challenge on an as-applied basis should suggest that we should give it less than the textual sweep that it has. I think, in fact, this court's decision in Kinney strongly suggests the opposite. It specifically says that atextual limiting constructions of this statute are inappropriate.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is that no one, I don't think, is disputing the tortious nature of the conduct, right? So, like, spot all of the stuff about the texts and everything else. Just, like, move on past that.
Okay.
The real question is it a 1985 subsection 3 violation and hence a predicate for 1988 fees? That's the real rub of it. And even in Goldman, even in the, like, what I would think of as like the high watermark, and I guess what we've established is our best case for this side of the argument, the Supreme Court goes out of its way to say, I'm sorry, the judge goes out of its way, excuse me, to say all of the hypothetical examples are involving the act of voting, right? It's like, you know, arresting someone so they can't go vote. It's barricading them in so they can't get to the ballot box. It's taking a ballot that was cast and destroying it. Like, it's not supporter advocacy in the sense that we're talking about today, and sort of this more freewheeling statutory right to police the nature of disagreement in the country.
So, Your Honor, I agree that Goldman uses some of those examples, but I think the, and I actually think, again, if memory serves, that Goldman uses an example of someone who is going to speak on behalf of a candidate as well as vote itself. I think there's nothing in the text of the statute that limits it to voting. I want to make that point again. Supporter advocacy, I think, is self-consciously broader than voting. We know that because vote, again, is three words away in the same statutory provision. Congress had enacted a law the year before that was specifically targeted at conspiracies for voting. But I also want to note that even if you thought that it had to be sort of a narrow understanding of supporter advocacy, this is about as close as it gets. We're talking about a campaign bus 4 days before the election. This was on October 30th, 2020. The election was on November 3rd. It has campaign surrogates on it. It is going, and excuse me, it's a wrapped bus, meaning that it's basically a driving billboard of a campaign ad. And then it is going, and there's testimony in the record on this, I believe this is at record 28478, that it's actually going to early voting sites. And this was, as I understand it, the last day of early voting in Texas in 2020. And so, you know, putting all of that together, we're really talking about core campaign advocacy, core advocacy to get out the vote, to encourage people to vote. And so I think even if you thought that supporter advocacy's kind of sales needed to be trimmed in some sense, this would not be the case in which to do that.
Can I ask one factual?
You can ask
one factual question.
Sure.
Is there evidence in the record of the lawful entitlement to vote for each of the plaintiffs?
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not know the answer to that question. I imagine somebody at council table might. I don't. I don't think that that was contested, and so I don't know one way or the other whether there was evidence in the record.
Would it matter if it was contested? I mean, it's an element of the claim, right?
It is an element of the claim. I'm sorry. I mean, and you know what? Let me quickly just check, because it may be in the jury instructions, which I do have right here. I believe that either there was evidence or it was stipulated. That's all I meant by not contested.
Oh, I see.
I don't believe
sorry.
That there was an issue at the trial at all about this.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. You have your argument.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I think it's very important, if I may add, that the record does show that Wendy Davis had voted a week before the incident, and that the two other plaintiffs in this case voted either in the District of Columbia, in Maryland, or in Virginia. They were not Texans, and we were here in Texas during what happened. I think it's also important to note that when you talk about the difference between the first part of 1985, subsection 3, and the second part, you're talking about two different things. The first part of it talks about something that's ingrained in the 14th Amendment that refers back to 14th Amendment and privileges and immunities and due process. Whereas the second part talks about support and advocacy. There's no place in the Constitution for support and advocacy. You have to refer to the First Amendment to look at rights of speech, rights of demonstrating and putting out your what you believe in. And it's for those reasons that this law, save for the first part of section 1985, subsection 2, when it talks about preserving the court systems at a very troubled time after the war between the states, and when there was a lot of chaos in the South. The army was still down there, and we had to make sure that newly re-enfranchised, liberated people were able, or their rights were going to be protected. This thing refers to the First Amendment right, and in order to bring a First Amendment right, you have to have government interference. I don't think that the issues before this court have to do with anything of all of the turmoil that was the Trump train that began up north in Texas by Tarrant County and swung all the way down, being followed the whole time by the Trump train. Regardless of the fact that my client wasn't really the conspirator that organized the statewide Trump train. He was somebody that was caught on a hook and was made an example. I want to point out something very important too that this court must consider, and I'm referring to one of my Click cases, the McClellan case, and I'm trying not to read here, the McClellan case, which is very important because what that does is that it points out that you have a triangle for a conspiracy. And in that triangle for a conspiracy, you have to have, and I'm going to, I can't quote it here because I left the writing elsewhere, but you have that triangle of a conspiracy that needs to have something like either beating somebody up, killing somebody, or burglary, or trespassing, or something like that. But the judge of the court clearly states what it presented to the jury, that the criminal act or that the illegal act was the violation of 1985 subsection 3. And that flies in the face of this court's decision in McClellan. But with that, Your Honor, I say that these civil rights laws that bolster the 14th Amendment that were being produced in the 1870s in order to protect the newly enfranchised Americans, that law requires that we hold people, that we hold a position there for, you have to have an animus recognized, whether it's race, sex, national origin, religion, but not things like jobs, employment, or economic, and much less politics. Imagine what it would do to our political system if now all of a sudden, if somebody goes up to someone wearing a Trump hat and hits them, I'm going to sue you under the KKK Act. And like that, it's going to completely chill our electoral process that right now isn't even more Trump.
Did your client appeal? I mean, did your client present any language for instruction number 15 on specific intent that was given to the jury, and or any alternative language, or object to the language that was presented?
I think our objection was general, Your Honor, and I don't think that I can answer that question right off the bat.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. We have your argument. We have both arguments. We appreciate them, and the case is submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you. The court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.